Kate. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I will move quickly. My name is Kai McGee. In my professional life, I manage the project in the state of Iowa that recruits and retains foster and adoptive families. And in my personal life as a foster parent and as a gay woman, one of the things that I quickly realized when I moved to Iowa was that because we want gay marriage, the battle isn't over. There's a lot of areas where we still have a lot of ground to cover and some folks who are still kind of left on the outside. In particular, the population that I'm speaking of is youth that identify as LGBTQ, or queer youth. In Iowa, there are approximately 800 to 1,500 LGBTQ youth who are served every year by either the foster care system or the juvenile justice system. But Iowa, as of yet, does not have policies, codes, and practice standards in place that prevent those particular youth from experiencing discrimination and hostility in their various placement environments. It's not unheard of, and in fact is even very common for LGBTQ youth to be ejected from their foster homes or to go into a group care facility of some sort or a detention center of some sort and experience anything that can be arranged from affirming and positive environments to hostile, discriminatory, and extremely negative environments. Many of these youth ultimately run away or force disruption from that placement. And end up residing on the streets where they report they actually feel safer than they do living in their assigned placement. As you can see, this is obviously an area where we are much in need of reform, and I want to take a moment to thank Mr. Matt McCoy, who's been kind of leading the charge on this issue in Iowa for a while. Because of the need that I saw, I started an organization known as Affirm, who is working with the state to address some of the reforms needed around this particular issue to make sure that all of our youth are being served and protected by our systems of care in Iowa. Benjamin Franklin once said something like, "Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as the people who are affected." This is a position, a belief, or principle that I have lived by in my personal and professional life for a number of years. And so when I started evaluating our three Democratic presidential candidates, I started doing that with an eye towards who best meets this principle. And I found one candidate who clearly stood above the rest. This particular candidate, Mr. Martin O'Malley, former mayor of Baltimore and then governor of Maryland, has a long history and tradition of standing up to public opinion when it's not necessarily easy or expedient to do so, maintaining his principles and convictions despite whatever the latest opinion polls might say, and resisting extreme personal pressure, sometimes even from his own faith leaders, to avoid taking the positions that he takes. He's long taken a stand towards addressing the needs of a lot of our invisible populations in this country. I appreciate that. As mayor of Baltimore, Mr. Martin O'Malley signed gender identity into one of the categories of prohibited discrimination acts. As the mayor of Maryland, he oversaw Maryland becoming the eighth state in the country to approve same-sex marriage, as well as becoming one of the first states in the country to recognize same-sex marriages performed out of state. As governor of Maryland, he extended health care property protections for same-sex couples. But one of the things that's really the most important to me and that stands out the most is that he wisely used data-based evidence-based systems to encourage the state of Maryland to change their strategies towards child welfare and juvenile justice. Under his care, Maryland reduced the number of children entering foster care by 50%, which is a feat almost unheard of in this country. I don't want to take any more of your time today, but I will tell you there are two actions that you can take today when you leave here. The first action that you can take is tell everybody you know that we need as many foster and adoptive parents in Iowa as we can get. We need to make sure that when our queer youth are entering these systems of care, that there is an affirming and safe home for them to go to when they need it. And then the next thing that you can do is go forth from here and speak on behalf of somebody who has lived by his principles for a long, long time, and that's to speak on behalf of Governor O'Malley. I want to welcome Mr. Governor Martin O'Malley.
Thanks very, very much. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Kai, thank you very much, and it's wonderful to be here with all of you. And Kai, thank you for pointing out what we did on foster care. I can honestly say that in the many introductions that I've been enjoyed and listened to, you're the first person to highlight what we did on reducing foster care placements by 50%. When I was running for governor and leaving the office of mayor, and by the way, I loved the office of mayor, you never had to explain to anyone why you were doing what you were doing or whether or not it was working. I love that office. But I used to play this game with myself, this mental exercise, because I knew from my service as mayor just how badly our state institutions, juvenile services and social services, were. So I played this game with myself that when I'm locked in the little room calling people for money in the run for governor, that every $25,000 I raised was another young life we'd save. And that's how I kept going. And there are very few things that were as gratifying as using big data, common platforms, to make sure that every individual person in our care mattered and that their life was safeguarded. We also cut juvenile homicides in half. I don't think it's coincidental. I think it's causal. You know. So anyway, look, they told me 5 minutes. And then, so it's wonderful to be here. It's great to see State Senator Matt McCoy and also Taylor Vanderkroll, one of my favorite county chairs in all of Iowa, because he's endorsed my campaign for president. And I also want to thank Jonathan Wilson and all of you for giving me the opportunity to stop by. 5 minutes. You know, you mentioned, I thought when you were talking about marriage equality, and the battle that we had in our state, I pulled up on my iPad to see if I still had it, a letter I wrote back to the Archbishop of Baltimore, who, when our third attempt at passing marriage equality, I finally pulled my friends together and said, look, we've tried everything except making this a governor's priority. Let's make it a governor's priority. Put our heads down and get this done. And the bishop was none too pleased. The bishop wrote me a cease and desist letter. I wrote back to the bishop, and I went through about 20 drafts before I wrung it out of all the anger that I had in between those pages. So what I share with you is the last draft, not the first. But I think it expresses who I have always aspired to be anyway, as a public servant. And so in the interest of time, maybe I'll read that. It's short. Dear Archbishop, I write in response to your letter on the public issue of equality of civil marriage rights in the state of Maryland. On this bridge we share between the secular and the sacred, you and I see very much alike on many public issues affecting the good order and the common good of the pluralistic society that is our beloved United States of America, eradicating poverty, expanding economic opportunity, promoting the dignity of work and the justice of fair wages, respecting the rights of workers to organize, acknowledging the justice of a fair and progressive income tax, recognizing the dignity of every human being, including as yet unauthorized immigrants, repealing the death penalty, reducing the incidence of infant mortality, providing a quality education for every child regardless of wealth, protecting God's natural creation for the benefit of future generations, reducing violent crime, rebuilding our cities, healing the sick, feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, visiting the imprisoned. I do not presume, nor would I ever presume, as governor, to question or infringe upon your freedom to define, to preach about, and to administer the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church. But on the public issue of granting equal civil marital rights to same-sex couples, you and I disagree. As I shared with you and your colleagues at the Catholic Conference during the candidate interview of the last re-election campaign. As governor, I've sworn to uphold the law without partiality or prejudice. When shortcomings in our laws bring about a result that is unjust, I have a public obligation to change that injustice. I have concluded that discrimination against individuals based on their sexual orientation in the context of civil marital rights is unjust. I have also concluded that treating the children of families headed by same-sex couples with lesser protections under the law than children of families headed by heterosexual parents is also unjust. And close is my full statement of July 22nd. I look forward to working with you on other issues of mutual agreement. So that's my 5 minutes. Let me conclude by saying this. Look, I need your help. I love your state. I love the beauty of your state. I love the warmth and the kindness of your people. And what I love most about your state is in this place, every individual matters. And many times you have sorted through the noise and the old agendas and the big money and the influence that tries to determine the outcomes of our elections before anybody has the chance to caucus or vote. And you sort through that and you lift up a new leader. I was born the year that John Kennedy was killed. My parents were both part of that generation Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation. My wife Katie and I have four terrific kids. There's nothing we wouldn't do to give them a better country and a life with more health, more security, and more opportunity. And that's what this election is all about. 8 years ago, you lifted up a new leader in Barack Obama to move our country forward. And that's what he's done. 70 months in a row of positive job growth. But here's another 70 number for you that we also have to own and acknowledge. 70% of us are earning the same or less than we were 12 years ago. And that's not the way our country's supposed to work. That's not the way our economy's supposed to work. But the good news is we can change that if we remember that our economy is not money, it's people. It's all of our people. And no people ever gave their children a better future by making their own nation weaker or by turning away from the challenges ahead. I put forward in your state 15 strategic goals to move our country forward, to rebuild the truth of the American dream we share. I'm the only candidate to put forward a plan to move us to a 100% clean electric grid by 2050. I put forward a plan to make debt-free college an option in the United States again within the next 5 years. I put forward a plan for making national service a universal option for every young person in our country, to eradicate childhood hunger within the next 5 years, to reduce overdose deaths and gun deaths, and all of these fall under the category in this race as things that I have already worked on or already accomplished at the state level. In conclusion, I believe that the genius of our nation is that in every generation we take actions, not words, but actions, to include people more fully in the economic, social, and political life of our nation. That's what makes our economy grow. That's what expands generational wealth and generational opportunity. And that's what we need to return to again as Americans. I know this is a tough fight, but I have always been drawn to tough fights. I believe the toughness of the fight is the way the hidden God has of telling us we're fighting for something worth saving. Our country's worth saving. Our children's future is worth saving. This planet's worth saving. I need your help. I hope you'll caucus for me February 1st. I look forward to our conversation here this morning. Thanks. Now the fun part, Q&A. Yes, sir.
That problem of your monitor or person that you're talking with, whatever, telling you you have to stop everything, you don't have a problem at all with that. I noticed that on your debate thing. And I said, you're not following the rules, Governor.
Yeah.
Sometimes the rules don't need to be followed if they're not right. And you're making a difference in that.
Hey, man, thank you. It's frustrating up there sometimes on that stage. But I don't make the rules. I just offer the candidacy and you decide. So, yes, sir.
Would you be willing to comment on the situation in Oregon and comment on whether it would be treated differently if the people occupying federal property word color.
Yeah, I have not seen that latest. Is there latest news on this?
Nothing more than they're still there. The local sheriff asked them to leave and they haven't.
Yeah, this is criminal behavior. This is breaking and entering. This is criminal behavior. I think there are many people who have pointed out that if the people engaged in this criminal behavior were American Muslims, rather than calling themselves militia, that there would be a different response, or if they were people of color. And I think all of that is true. Having said that, I also trust that the authorities are doing everything in their power to resolve this without any loss of life. Sometimes that requires a greater degree of patience. And one would hope that if the situation did involve people of a different persuasion, that such restraint would be used to save lives in that instance as well. But I don't think that the public's attitude would be quite the shrug that it is. Yes, sir.
Yes. The Republicans are really pointing guns at you and everything. And what do you feel about what President Obama did with the gun control? I mean, honest and core true, you don't have automatic guns unless you're going to kill people.
Honest and for true. I'm going to use that later on today. I totally agree with you. Yeah, I support the president and what he's doing. One of my 15 strategic goals is that we as a nation cut gun deaths in half within the next 10 years. Part of that involves, I mean, there are several actions to that, but one of them is certainly restoring common sense gun regulations and laws to our nation. It was not that long ago when combat assault weapons were banned on our streets. And that didn't interrupt anybody's hunting season, did it? In fact, I've never met a self-respecting hunter that needed an AR-15 to down a deer. Have you? You know? So, after the slaughter of those kids in that Connecticut classroom, I brought my state together and we passed comprehensive gun safety legislation with a ban on combat assault weapons, universal background checks, and a ban on magazines with more than 10 rounds. And about a month ago, I put forward 7 executive actions the president could take, and a couple of them are the things that he's talking about in his latest actions. The armor-piercing bullets, I don't know if he mentioned that one. Yes, I think that was one of them. And using our buying power, we're the biggest purchaser of weapons in the country, it's our own government. If we insisted on highest and best safety technologies, we could save lives. So I agree with you. Look, I'm going to continue to advocate for it. You can't accomplish anything in office if you don't have the guts to campaign on it when you're seeking the mandate. I believe that how you govern or how you campaign determines how you govern. So while none of this is easy, I do believe it's important that we call forward the goodness in our country rather than just bemoaning the fact that we're gridlocked by extreme views. Yes, sir. That's the question table back there. What'd they feed you guys in your eggs?
What's a proposal, what's an idea that you have for helping the Common Core, whose wages and all have been stagnant for the last 30 years or so, which you think could go through a Republican-controlled House?
Yeah, and let's also remember in this impermanent world of ours that just as you and I won't be here forever, neither will this Congress. So every 2 years, there's an opportunity to change our Congress, and redistricting will come about again. We are not forever as a nation saddled with an unrepresentative House of Representatives. Expectations do become behavior, and I expect that we will recover our balance and our ability to make our government work. So these are some of the things that I mentioned that I believe will get wages to go up rather than down. Part of the theory that we were saddled with for 30 years prior to President Obama was trickle-down economics. Concentrate wealth at the top, remove regulation everywhere, including even in our labor market, right? And keep wages low so we can be more competitive, whatever the hell that means. But you've never seen a stalk of corn grow from the tassel down. And nor does our economy grow that way. It's from the middle out and from the middle up. The more people earn, the more they spend, the more our economy grows. So it stands to reason then, if 70% of us are earning the same or less than we were 12 years ago, and 70% of economic growth comes from consumer demand, we're not seeing the demand that we need to in our economy. So it's I look at our economy in kind of ecosystemic terms. And so here are the actions we can take in order to make our middle class grow and get wages to go up again. Ever since 1947, up until 1980 anyway, we always kept the minimum wage above the poverty line for a family of two. We need to raise the minimum wage. I'm in favor of raising it to $15 an hour, however we can, wherever we can, and acknowledging that, yes, some cities will get there before the nation does. I still believe those minimum wage standards are important, and they haven't been raised for a long time. They've slipped below the poverty line. Equal pay for equal work. Now, this is something the president did just within the last year, I think, raising that threshold. We need to keep it raised. Equal pay for equal work between men and women, paid family leave, making it easier for people to bargain collectively and not harder. There are things we can do with our own Justice Department to ensure that. Getting 11 million of our neighbors out of the off-the-books underground shadow economy by passing comprehensive immigration reform. Now, as you listen to some of those things, you probably said, yeah, but that'll require Congress. Yes, it will. And I'm not giving up on the things that require Congress. I am the only one of the people sometimes ask me, I should say all the time ask me. The most recurrent question I get all across your state and every state is, how are you going to work with this Congress? Which was inherent in your question. The better question is, which of the three of us has the best shot of moving us forward out of these divided times? Because whenever our nation faces this sort of stalemate and gridlock, one key ingredient of moving us beyond it is new leadership. And time and time again, I've brought people together in my own state to get difficult things done. And oftentimes it didn't happen the first time. It took us three times to get marriage equality done. It took us three times to repeal the death penalty. And we got both of those things done only with some Republican votes. So I felt I had a responsibility to get to know all of the Republican legislators, to have a relationship with them as a human being, and not to just assume that since they vote against my stuff 98% of the time, they're not good enough to give me a 2% vote every now and again. And that's what you have to do. Each issue is a different combination lock. And the office of the president is a very, very powerful office. And in order to be effective with Congress, you have to be engaged with that power on a personal level with all the members. Yes, sir. Hi.
Governor, I apologize for taking you away from policy. But I'm a parent of four-year-old twins, and it's important to me to teach them the value that we work on behalf of others, we serve others in our family. Can you tell me about a time when you've seen one of your four children actively demonstrate some of the principles and values that you yourself have lived by?
Yeah, I could probably tell you many times. You're going to make me cry, though. One of the things I miss most about, or the toughest things about presidential campaign is the time away from my kids. And time away from my family. My oldest daughter is a public school teacher in the first grade at Walter P. Carter Elementary School. And that's something she's done now for 3 years as part of Teach for America. And I have never been so proud of any of my kids as I am of her when I see her actually in the middle of the lives of those first graders that depend on her. And it's not with a coldness or an aloofness. She's right there with them, you know, understanding what their family situation is, going the extra mile to get that permission slip to take them on the school trip that she's paying for, all of those sorts of things. She represents the best my family's ever produced. Yes?
I appreciate your fervor for the social issues, and your 15 points are great, and I appreciate the fact that you're wanting to keep America great, so thank you for all that. I do think we all realize, in addition to that, that the world is flat, and that there is enormous unrest in our world, I think it goes without saying, and so many of us have concerns, and I've chatted with some of your team, actually, before about, you know, one global issue can put all that stuff on the back burner and cause us, you know, to possibly become more united in a weird way. But what do we? Could you speak to the state of the world, the unrest in the world? What just in North Korea the other day, stuff like that, Iran. These global issues, these global powers that wish to do us harm. Of course, there's ISIS. That kind of stuff. It's unpopular, disturbing topic, I think. But if that all goes awry, then keeping America great is going to shift.
Right. Yeah, the first job of the President of the United States is to protect us, to protect the people of the United States. As the one candidate in this race who has 15 years of executive experience, that's a responsibility that I've had integrated into my daily life every day of that service. My first thing that I would look at in the morning was the overnight printout at the console in the either on my hip or on the console there at the bottom of the governor's residence that listed how many lives were lost on a day-to-day basis on that day last year compared to this year, traffic deaths, overdose deaths, and things like that. Two governors, governors have led us successfully to victory in two world wars. There is a discipline one develops as a chief executive, an understanding of creating feedback loops. Every day is a different crisis. And you develop an instinct to get inside the turning radius of that crisis, to head it off before it turns on you. And that's something that I've developed when I ran for mayor of Baltimore. It was not because our city was doing well. We were the most violent city in America. And we needed to bring people together across some pretty big racial and class divides in order to save a lot of lives, put us on a path for the biggest crime reductions in America over the next 10 years. Every year after the attacks of 9/11, though, my colleagues in the U.S. Conference of Mayors and my colleagues in the National Governors Association, year in and year out, elected me to be one of their two leaders on homeland security and preparedness. Every day in office as a mayor, because of Baltimore being kind of in the center of the triangle of those attacks, we pursued 12 core capacities to improve homeland security in my city and then in my state. It's akin when fighting Al-Qaeda here in the homeland. It's the best metaphor I can suggest to you is it's like your immune system in your own body. It's able to protect you from the bad bugs in the world, not because it outnumbers them, but because it's better coordinated. It can adapt more quickly. It's better connected. And so among those 12 core capacities that every state should be pursuing is a functional fusion center to analyze intelligence, to be able to connect the dots that would help you to identify not only sleeper cells, but also the death gangs and the drug gangs here in our own country. They kill a lot of our people. We also have interoperable communications, a biosurveillance system, making sure you had adequate bomb coverage, bomb squad coverage, networking and integrating your security cameras around your critical infrastructure and transportation, and drilling and training every single day in an all-hazards, all-crime sort of approach. I have led trade delegations all around the world. I've met with many heads of state, and the President appointed me to be one of two chairs of the Council of Governors, whose job it was to meet with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Homeland Security. On my website is a talk that I gave to a lot of our returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. They call themselves the Truman Project. They found themselves guarding oil wells in the Middle East, and they said there's got to be a better foreign policy than this for our country. And the gist of that talk is that we need a new foreign policy of engagement and collaboration with like-minded people around the world. We need a new national security strategy that's better at looking over the horizon and identifying these threats and forging regional alliances to mitigate them before we're backed into the corner of having to take out another safe haven for terrorists. We haven't gotten there yet. We need to get there. And in order to develop both of those things, though, we have to make ourselves stronger at home. We have to act according to our principles here at home, which not only means making an economy that's inclusive, where our cities don't break out in riots because structural unemployment's higher now than it was 8 years ago, where we stop expanding the largest network of immigrant detention camps of any nation on the planet. You know, we have to act in alignment with our principles here at home if we're going to have credibility in crafting that new foreign policy and a more effective national security strategy for these times, which has to be all about protecting the global commons we share and making sure that there are regional alliances that can prevent vacuums that give rise to terror safe havens. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Lifted here, you talked on about your demonstrated commitment to have policies that protect transgender Americans. That's something you definitely did in Maryland. I really appreciate that you've done that. All communities or politicians are doing more issues with trans community places. You definitely have not done that. So I'd love to hear what sort of policies you would advocate for as president to continue protecting trans Americans.
Yeah, thank you. Many years ago, I guess they gave, by the way, Ben is here. He waved the commit to caucus card at me. Ben is one of the most tireless, loyal, hardworking guys that I've ever worked with on any campaign. Ben, thank you. But Ben has a secret, and I have to share it with you. If Ben goes home at night without having signed up at least 10 more people to commit to caucus for O'Malley, he cries himself to sleep. So please don't let him do that today. I guess, Ben, this is a record piece, huh, that we passed around. So I would refer you to those pieces. My final year in office, I passed a transgender anti-discrimination bill in my state. Well, my first year as mayor, I testified in favor of that. So it took us as a state 15 years to get it done. In the meantime, we passed a municipal ordinance in the city of Baltimore, and some other counties followed. And once you got critical mass, I suppose it became easier to do that at the state level. Early on when I was on the Baltimore City Council many, many years ago, we passed domestic partnership benefits. That seems so quaint now. It seems so quaint. At the time, it was considered controversial. There were 10 of us that co-sponsored it, and 10 was the magic number to get it passed, and I was one of those 10. I mentioned the marriage equality. I was also very engaged with our own school system. My wife's one of her main issues. She's a judge, a district court judge. So in addition to putting in a full time on the bench, one of the issues she cared very, very passionately about and led was better policies in our whole school system to combat bullying and the sort of pain and suffering that kids inflict on other kids in our school system. Look, I think it's all about taking actions that that respect the dignity of every person. The freedom of Exodus was not merely a freedom from oppression, it was a freedom for full participation. And that's what's at my core as a public servant. And I look forward, and I think we all have an opportunity to work on many, many fronts to deliver that promise closer to reality.
For myself, I see politicians and public figures. The first responsibility is to help educate the public. So many of our problems, social problems, come from ignorance and lack of exposure to, you know, for a long time it was gay people.
Mm-hmm.
Transgender is a new way of educating the public about other people they may not be familiar with. And so often ignorance is just fed by fear. It's that, you know, I look at the other side of the political spectrum right now, and Republican candidates are, to me, feeding ignorance rather than providing the educational and the background information that leaders should be providing. I'm happy to say I think all Democratic candidates have done a good job of trying to explain their issues and what they want to do. But I'd like to see you do a little bit more in trying to educate the public about those issues that so many people try to feed with fear.
Right.
You know, that ignorance would try to feed with fear.
Yeah, and you know, so much of it comes down to it's easy to scapegoat a group of people that you've never met. You know, it was always fascinating to me in my own state, the pockets of my state that had the greatest raging hate for new American immigrants were the places in my state where none lived. It's I guess part of our human condition. The word, I think, is understanding, right? A very good friend of mine who's a big thinker guy out in California, he says, I think your whole campaign should be about understanding. What we need in our country is a deeper level of understanding, because understanding precedes action. You can't take actions unless you understand. And part of the role of the President of the United States is the explainer in chief, right? To explain some really complex things and systems.
And everybody thinks that, you know, gay people live in New York City or San Francisco. Gay people live in Des Moines, Iowa.
Amen.
And they can get married here.
Gotcha. I agree. Yes, sir.
What do you think the odds are that we'll be able to get more Democrat debates on the schedule? How do you feel about how that's gone so far?
I'm just trying to make sure they hold the ones that they have planned. I mean, the concentration of wealth and power in our country has also taken place within our own party. There are some in our own party that would like to make the remaining debates that we have more exclusive. Would like to turn them into a two-person affair. So that's what I'm fighting back on. Some good news that I heard on this front, though, is that CNN's going to do something that they're not allowed to call a debate, because this year in the undemocratic actions of the Democratic Party, we only are allowed to have four debates before caucus time. So they have to call them other things. So there will be the Brown and Black Forum on the 11th. Used to be a debate, but now it has to be a forum. And there will also be, I've heard word of the CNN doing a town hall forum, where we won't all be there at the same time, but we'll each walk through for 25 minutes of our town hall. So that's good. The more the better, I think. I think folks are just waking up. And in Iowa, you guys must get calls all year round from all the campaigns. And you're just so very polite and adept at not making up your mind until the last 2 weeks. But now we're in that decision envelope. And my sense is that people are very interested in this. In East Des Moines the other night, there was a mock caucus, and it was a three-way tie. I think our party would be very well served by an extended debate. Certainly, when they're not hiding our debates, if people are able to tune in and find them, I think they see a better conversation, a search for understanding, asking the right questions. And so I hope we have more. And in the meantime, I see the man coming up, the hook. I need your help. Mayor County told me that I'd enjoy being with this group, and I have. And I thank you so much for what you do for the life of your state, and therefore the life of our country. Please help me in this campaign. Do that which Iowa has always done best. Lift up a new leader that will move our country forward. And I thank you all so very, very much.
Appreciate you being here. It is a token of appreciation that we give to our speakers a CD recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus that we hope you will enjoy.
I heard it at the I heard the chorus at the JJ dinner.
Well, now you can hear it again.
Good.
Governor, I don't want you to be overly concerned about the polls. I have routinely for the last year been lying to the pollsters. I've even written an article in our newsletter encouraging our members to lie to the pollsters. I've been a 90-year-old Jewish black woman who's active on the internet and is for sure going to the caucus, and I'm going to the caucus for Mr. Trump. So I have been all over the map, and so the polls are not necessarily reliable in Iowa leading into the caucuses. And on the Republican field of candidates, I'm reminded of a story, a guy standing on a street corner, and this huge crowd goes running by, and shortly thereafter, this one lone runner comes chugging along, huffing and puffing, and he asks the fellow on the corner, "Have you seen a big crowd go by?" And he said, "Yes." And he says, "Which way did they go?" And he told him. And then he said, "Why do you ask?" And the lone runner said, "Well, I'm their leader." And it seems to me that in many respects, the pandering candidates in the Republican Party are following the very worst among us. And too many of them dominate that party. We have been blessed to have now a third presidential candidate speak to the Breakfast Club. The first was Howard Dean, then was Tom Vilsack, and now Martin O'Malley. We are 501c3. We therefore have to protect that status. And this is how I do it. Anyone who is partisan who wants to speak to our breakfast club simply has to ask. We haven't had a request from a Republican candidate yet. It's not our fault. Obviously, Governor O'Malley is involved in politics. The fact of the matter is, if you have two teenagers and one car, you've got politics. And we are all involved in politics. And we're involved in politics whether we go to the caucus or whether we don't. If we sit at home, we've been involved and we've endorsed whatever happens that night. It is imperative in a vibrant democracy that will survive that we get actively involved in politics, that we go to those caucuses, that we sit through the interminable 2 or 3 hours that it takes to do the caucusing and support a candidate that we think would make the best president. We have heard this morning from someone who could be the next president of the United States, someone who could be the next leader of the free world, someone who could be in charge when all of these various unpredictable issues arise, or someone in the Joe Biden tradition who could be a heartbeat away from the President of the United States with those same responsibilities. We've been privileged to have you here today. Thank you very much. And truth be known, if I were as articulate as the governor, I'd be running for president. Okay, next meeting is in February. February the 5th, same time, same place. Our speaker will be Susanna DeBacca. She is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. She took over from Jill June. She is a powerhouse. You will not want to miss that meeting. She's an excellent spokesperson for Planned Parenthood. We'll look forward to seeing you on the 5th of February. Thank you.